Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Forage stocks in South Dakota are running low. How does the soggy spring impact livestock down the road? And what kind of relief is available for farmers and ranchers from Congress? U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson joins us this morning on the phone for a look at bipartisan efforts in Washington to answer the call for those here at home. Congressman Johnson, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for taking time.
Hey, thanks, Lori. It's always a pleasure.
And you are in South Dakota now. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, we don't start votes until tomorrow. And so now this will be a tough week. We're doing appropriations bills. And, you know, last week when we were doing that, there were votes as late as 1 in the morning. And I suspect we'll get a bit more of that this week.
All right. Look, walk us through for our conversation today. Walk us through what the problem is with forage stocks in South Dakota right now. What are you hearing from farmers and producers?
Well, I would tell you, I think most people, even in Washington, D.C., as urban as an environment that is, people understand that because of the wet weather, corn and soybeans are, we don't have as many acres planted as we want. That's not just a South Dakota problem. There are probably 10 or 12 states that are seriously impacted in that way. So I've heard the word soybeans probably 100 times on the floor of the U.S. House between the China negotiations and the wet spring. But one word I have not heard a single time on the House floor is forage. And there's just not a, forage is what you feed livestock. And I don't think there's an understanding that the wet spring, because it set back the corn guys, also means that we're going to have less to put in the bellies of the 5 million South Dakota beef and dairy cattle we've got running around. And if there's nothing to put in the bellies of those animals, those producers may be in a situation where they have to start to sell down their herd earlier than they normally would, move those animals further south to where there is feed available for them. We don't want that. We want producers to manage the size of their herd on the basis of what is right for them, not because they simply don't have anything to feed their animals.
So help us understand, is this a local market where, you know, the silage is coming and the, you know, the hay and the silage is coming from South Dakota farmers to other South Dakota producers? Is it, how regional is the market?
Yeah, I mean, you can, of course, haul things like hay across great distances, but that increases cost. And silage, you can haul silage, of course, but that increases cost. And that all factors in the economic analysis that these producers are making about whether or not they are going to hold on to their cattle. And at some point, it does become a regional and national issue. I mean, we have a distinct possibility that we may have 25% less corn grown in the Corn Belt that we had last year. We don't know that yet, but that seems like it's a perfectly reasonable, it's within the reasonable range. And if that's the case, it is going to get to be a national problem about what do we feed all of America's livestock.
Tell us when a farmer has to delay planting, how the insurance works on that. What's prevent plant insurance? And that's going to tie into what you see as some potential solutions for the problem.
Yeah, great question. So when we do have crop insurance mechanisms available, farmers pay the premiums on the acres that they want to have insured. Many farmers don't insure all their acres. They're making a determination about which fields are most likely to be wet in any given year. But when they do pay premiums on those crop insurance acres, when it's too wet to be able to plant, they can claim prevent plant, saying, I wasn't able to get into the field, so now I want my insurance payment. And that pays 55% of, historically what they would have received on that ground. Now, part of the trade-off on the insurance policy is that if you claim prevent plant and go in and, as you should, plant a cover crop. So these would be crops like a forage sorghum or a ryegrass or a radish, oats. That is to keep the soil in place and to improve the soil quality. You go in with this cover crop. You can't go then harvest that cover crop in September or October as a cash crop. The insurance company says, hey, listen, you said you couldn't get a cash crop in there, so you don't get to harvest that cover crop. The legislation that we've introduced would change that during emergency situations like now.
Tell us about that act and its bipartisan support, the FEED Act. What are folks in Congress, how are they getting on board with the conversation and with a potential solution?
Sure. Well, and I should tell you, producers that I'm talking to, they don't want another government program. They can't feed their livestock dollar bills. So what they want is just a little bit more flexibility to be able to feed the livestock with products they already have on their own farm or ranch. The current rules, as we talked about, prohibit you from going in and haying or grazing or chopping these cover crops until after November 1st. We just this legislation that I've introduced would move that November 1st date up to September 1st. Now, it would give RMA, the crop insurance manager, the flexibility to do that during emergency time. So you're going to get a lot more nutrients out of those cover crops in September and October, and that's going to help these herds make it through the end of the season. And this is bipartisan. I mean, one of the things that I really enjoyed, Lori, about Washington, D.C., is that when it comes to ag issues, you can build good bipartisan coalitions. Freshman Democrat Andrew Craig from Minnesota has carried a lot of water on this legislation. He and I have worked together to try to build a bipartisan coalition. Colin Peterson, the Democratic chairman of the House Ag Committee, has been very supportive of this bill. He's also an original co-sponsor. These are people who understand row crop country. These are people who understand cattle country. And we've got already now, although it's only been a week since we've introduced it, we have 17 national ag groups that have stepped forward and said this would be good policy for the country.
Does the bill isolate something that would be a forage crop from another cover crop? I mean, is it the same, for a sorghum as it is for radish, for example?
Yeah, well, the crop insurance policy contracts that these producers sign make it clear what are allowable cover crops. And it's a pretty wide variety, although you can't go and plant corn as a cover crop or soybeans, but there are more than a dozen other crops that you could plant. Now, almost all of those crops do have some nutritional value as feed to cattle. And so opening that from November 1st to something like September 1st would have real value for, as I said, the 5 million head we have in South Dakota.
Talk about, when we typically talk of cover crops, we talk about long-term conservation and the incentives for that. How does a bill like this in times of disaster, which is difficult to predict, how does that feed into that larger long-term conservation and good farming practices overall?
Well, I think it makes people a little more likely to make those good conservation decisions. You know, we've got producers who right now are still busy planting. We've had a drier week, which has been good. It's let people get a lot of work done. But, you know, as I sit here in South Dakota now, there's rain falling. And there are producers right now that are going to have to decide, do I try to mud in some soybeans or is maybe now the right time to declare prevent plant? If in the back of their minds they know that that prevent plant could provide them the difference between a cattle operation that works and one that doesn't this year, they might be more likely to get that cover crop in rather than mud in some beans. And I should mention that this is, and obviously relying on an act of Congress, Lori, is not very easy. Congress moves slowly. We do want this done quickly. And I think we picked up some momentum. There's a chance we could get Congress to act on this. But, I don't need the credit. Andy Craig doesn't need the credit. If we can get RMA, again, the crop insurance manager within USDA, to make this decision administratively, that's a win as well.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. Congressman Johnson, we're going to ask you to stick with us for just a moment. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk more about what's happening in the South Dakota ag industry. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson is in South Dakota today before heading back to Washington, and he's joining us on the phone right now. And Congressman Johnson, the U.S. Trade Office is beginning hearings this week for businesses to weigh in on trade with China, and there's a lot of talk about winners and losers in the trade battle and asking for specific things to happen. What are you hearing from farmers about? Do they feel like there is a way for them to come out as winners at this point in the trade war, the trade battles?
Yeah, and I just, you know, as a foundational point, I should make it clear, I mean, free markets are where it's at. I mean, market access provides South Dakota producers and manufacturers, for that matter, the opportunity to compete globally. And when they have an opportunity to compete, you know, they're going to win more than their fair share of battles. And so I'm a free trade guy, and I think, you know, the overwhelming majority of people within the ag industry especially are. And so seeing these disputes with China, this is hard, Lori. I mean, some of your listeners probably know that $2 off a bushel of soybeans, which has, you know, been the impact of the China disputes, that takes $500 million out of the economy in South Dakota. It's not a very big economy, but $500 million is a lot to pull out of it. And so producers that I talk to, they understand that they are bearing a disproportionate brunt of the disputes with China, but they also understand the long-term gains here. And I'll just give you one example. So NAFTA was a good trade deal. It might be the best trade deal in the history of humankind. It increased ag exports to China and Mexico over the course of the last 25 years by four times. It's been really good news for South Dakota producers. But the administration went and renegotiated NAFTA, and now we have USMCA, that, by the way, Congress has to get ratified this summer. It's a top legislative priority. Well, the difference between a really good deal in NAFTA and a great deal in USMCA is, according to independent third parties, 176,000 new American jobs and $68 billion of real GDP growth. Now, the only reason I mention that is because it gives some context for how a good deal with China could provide a tremendous amount of long-term value that I think, if we do it right, could dwarf this really uncomfortable short-term pain we are experiencing.
What is the process for the ratification of USMCA? You said earlier that, you know, good bipartisan coalitions are kind of easy to build around ag. What is the conversation about with that trade deal, USMCA?
Well, it is decidedly more difficult. You know, Speaker Pelosi is a very savvy, official. She's a very savvy manager of her caucus. She is not as big a fan of free trade as I am. And so she is, I think it's safe to say, quite skeptical of the agreement. You know, she and the president also don't get along. And so it is not typical for either of them to go out of their way to help the other. So you get, unfortunately, a pretty big dose of political politics dished into this. But one thing I've done is there's almost not a day that goes by that I don't sit down with one of my Democratic colleagues, the freshmen in particular. I know a number of them pretty well. And I would tell you, a lot of these folks are more moderate than you might believe. You know, there are folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that get all the headlines. She clearly is a stealth-styled liberal, but many of her colleagues, their politics trend more toward the center. Those are the people with whom I'm talking, and we're just having good conversations about how can we convince the speaker to put this on the floor.
Is one of the challenges, as you said, NAFTA was one of the possibly the best trade deal in the history of humankind. President Trump has said it was terrible. Is part of it just how NAFTA was is perceived by different people and different rhetoric surrounding it?
Well, I think you've got, you know, a difference in time. NAFTA started out really, really great, but that was 25 years ago. Like anything, or almost anything, it gets worse. In 25 years, there are portions that begin to look dated. So I think the president was really calling out the fact that NAFTA was not a perfect agreement for our modern age. It didn't have hardly anything to do with IT issues, with digital trade, with data privacy, with data piracy. And, you know, particularly as we look to USMCA helping us chart a course forward with China, it was really important that we address those things, as well as currency manipulation. So NAFTA was very good for the 90s. This update makes it a much stronger agreement.
The U.S. has also recently tied trade talks to migration in the dialogue with Mexico. Have you been supportive of that connection?
Well, I do. I think it is more concerning. I mean, I do applaud the president for entrepreneurially trying to find ways to address what's going on at the southern border. And I should tell you, whether you're on the right or on the left, you need to be concerned about what's going on at the southern border. Just in the last couple of years, we've seen an 8 or 9-fold increase in the number of apprehensions at the border. It is, it's staggering. And I've been down there, and whether you're more concerned about national security or about humanitarian issues, you should be upset. You should be angry at what is going on. And it is a situation that Washington, D.C. has not addressed properly. So I understand the president's frustration. I would tell you, you know, threatening tariffs, it probably works better as a threat than it does following through. You know, Mexico is a huge trade partner for us. I mean, there are 5 million American jobs that depend on that trade, and we're a lot better off when they're buying American corn than we are if they're not.
Do you see Congress moving forward on USMCA if there is still a crisis at the southern border with Mexico? Is that in the way of making the next best deal?
I think the USMCA is going to get done. It's not going to be easy. There are going to be a lot of us that are going to have to spend hundreds of hours in trying to move it forward. Everything in D.C. that gets done only after you invest way more effort than you should have to. But you know, listen, I get it. I mean, this is not, it's not supposed to be vacation. It's work. But I think if we work hard enough, there's a real shot that we are going to get USMCA done. And we also do need to do a better job addressing the border. But I think those will get done on parallel tracks rather than as a single unified package.
As you spend time, Congressman Johnson, here in South Dakota, I know you've posted some pictures of standing in some soggy spaces. And I'm sure, as you mentioned, hearing the word soybean talked about, you know, 100 times or more in Congress, what are the themes that keep coming up with farmers as you walk around and South Dakotans? What's on their mind as you take a visit home?
It's interesting, Lori, just psychologically, the tone changed about a month ago. I mean, in the 3 or 4 months prior to that, when I was talking to producers, they understood that this was going to be another difficult year. They knew they were going to be entering the fifth year of declining net farm income. But these are big boys and big girls. I mean, they are used to making million-dollar decisions. They feel called to feed the world and do it in a way that is a part of their culture and their tradition. And they understand that the stakes are high financially for them. And those are, you know, so for the longest time, they would talk about these as business issues to be worked through. But when the rain just would not stop, the calls turned from matter-of-fact frustration to real fear. And people who are not used to exhibiting weakness, they were scared, Lori, and I think that was a good message for them to share because it helped us in D.C. Start to get more aggressive in trying to find any way we could to help them.
Mm. Time to get to work. You take that personally, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Anybody who goes to Washington, D.C. and becomes dulled to the sight of the U.S. Capitol or becomes numb to the phone calls that come into the office. Any member of Congress who doesn't take some of those phone calls, him or herself, I think probably needs to look for other work. Because if you're not willing to remain connected to the idea that this is a tremendous honor, and if you're not willing to remain connected to the idea that you are there to make this country better, and that is all about people and about families and about communities, this is not an academic exercise, then I don't know that you're doing anybody a service by being there.
Congressman Dusty Johnson, thank you so much for your time. Travel safely back to Washington.
Thanks, Lori.